Cheryl Newman joined.
Cheryl, it's Stephanie. I'm here.
Hey, welcome.
Hey.
He's got through the governor.
I did. Not my thing.
I hear you. Cheryl Newman speaking. Who joined?
Jeannie Walton's here.
Hey, Jeannie. Welcome. I think we've got Cheryl and Steig and Stephanie Hendrickson. I don't know if you and Jeannie know each other.
Actually, we met at the Mike Ross Ride a couple years ago. She was helping out a couple friends of mine, LaDonna Klemmer and Christy Workman.
Oh, that was nice.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad I can help them.
Yeah.
And we'll see how things go. Okay. Who joined? This is Cheryl.
Allison Bailey.
Hey, Allison, welcome.
Allison,
congratulations.
Thank you.
That was absolutely incredible. That Stephanie and Jeannie know that Allison's Kazar won the Kazar with Sarah riding. So that's absolutely incredible.
Yeah, I watched that or followed that online.
It was quite a shock. Even being at the finish line, I just couldn't believe it when they came out of the woods by themselves. We had some friends stationed down at No Hands who called us and kind of were telling us who was going across and in what order. So we expected to see some sort of race off. And when she came out of the woods all by herself, well, we were quoted in the paper. They labeled us in the newspaper out there as boisterous. So that says it all. We did have Susan Casemeyer with us too, so we were boisterous.
So.
I've asked Dyke to moderate this because I've got an email I need to get out, unfortunately, and I think Steig and Eaton walk a straight line and moderate a call all at the same time, which is more than I can do.
Whether we want to wait a couple minutes, but just as background, Jeannie has been one of my mentors for many years and role model, and Jeannie, I think, as everybody knows, is both a very accomplished rider, was best condition at the first World Championship, and quite a few international medals, including team gold at the Pan Am, and I guess team gold at the Worlds, right, in 88, and also was the treatment vet at the 96 Olympics for, what, the three-day eventing, Jeannie, or what?
Yeah, for 3 days. Mm-hmm. And in our sport's much more exciting.
So, anyway, and I've always said, you know, if your horse isn't quite right at a ride, you want to go to Jeannie to have her treat it, but also Jeannie knows as better as anybody else in the sport how to read your horse and get the horse through the ride and get the best out of the horse that the horse can give you that day, or decide it's time for the horse to have a short day. So we thought it was a great follow-up to who just joined?
Rick Weisner.
Hey, Rick. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good.
Good. So I'm just giving a short introduction while we're waiting for people to join. So we thought it was a great follow-up to what Dwight talked about, which was how to lead your horse during training and then develop training goals to meet your goals, and then read your horse and adjust that. It'd be great now to talk about what do you do during a ride. So maybe why don't I thought Jeannie give just a few general words, and then we'll open it up to the questions, either questions that we've been around or general questions people have. So turn the floor over to Jeannie.
Oh, thank you.
And I'm going to put it on mute just so I don't generate noise on the line, and I'll come off mute when I need to.
I am really tickled to be asked to do this, and it is something that is a talent that I think as endurance riders we all need to develop, what happens along the way that you have to adjust to, because your adjustments are either going to allow you to continue or allow you to stop or make a mess of things, and those really are your only three choices. And there's nothing wrong with continuing. There's nothing wrong with stopping. There is always something wrong with making a mess of things. But a lot of times that is not anything that we could foresee or be able to tell. So I'm hoping I'm going to give you some things that you can use before you reach that point that tells you how to use your horse and how and what to expect from your horse and how to test your horse along the way to see where you are. Now, I have some questions here that they sent to me. Stag, should I start with those, you think?
Up to you. If you think it's good. Am I off mute?
You are now off mute.
You're not on.
Carol and I are sitting here with two cell phones close to one another, so you make it. There we go.
Yeah.
Either way, Gene, if you'd like to say it,
I'd like to.
Words first.
The whole thing seems to evolve about how you're going to do this with your horse. It says here, how do you strategize? What goes into deciding that strategy? That is hopefully an adaptive strategy. I mean, when you pick something to try or to do, it has an only if very plainly in front of it. Only if things are going well. Only if my horse feels good. Only if I'm capable of riding as hard as my horse is capable of going. So there's many only ifs with that. So how do I strategize? The first thing I need to know is I need to know about my horse's talents. Do I have a quiet horse that will gallop along all day? Do I have a horse that has this giant long trot and he can make pretty good time, but he can't really do rocks very well? I have a little horse that can climb mountains well. Do I have a horse that doesn't mind the heat? So when you start trying to figure out a strategy for a given ride, you have to figure out your horse's talents to start with. If you have a horse that goes well in the mountains and likes lots of hard work, and he can do hard work fast, that's the ride for you. If you have a horse that isn't particularly strong but can gallop all day, you might want to look for a flatter ride, a ride with maybe better consistent footing, a ride that's mainly in the woods where you don't get in the sun. If you have a horse that can't take the heat, a horse that doesn't mind the heat, a horse that doesn't mind humidity, all those things go into figuring out a strategy for the ride that you are going to pick, as well as the ride you are in, you're in right at this point. So the things that you need to know, you need to know what you know about your horse. You have to put that in the, in the mix. What do you know, and what do you think you know, and what don't you know at all? I mean, all these horses are at different places in their training. I mean, I have 300-mile horses right here in my field right now that can go out almost any day and do 100 miles, but they are clearly completely different animals. One has a giant long stride, and I don't know very much about her at all. I've had her on hundreds. I've had other people ride her. But my knowledge of her, my personal knowledge, is fairly limited. I broke her, and I've ridden around town, but I have never competed her myself. I have another one that I broke and trained myself, and she will go anywhere. She'll climb any mountain. She'll swim creeks. She'll just go. She doesn't care. She's not all that fast, but, boy, she can pin herself up to a fast horse and do just fine. Or she's brave enough to go by herself, but she whinnies a lot along the way when she's by herself, so she slows herself down. And then I have another with the most experienced of the three that I could take anywhere. I know exactly when I can ask her to go. I can ask her to go all day. She can climb mountains. She can work in sand. She can, work in mud. Old enough to be able to take these things. So y'all understand what I'm saying? You have to know what your horse has to offer before you can make a strategy. You have to know things about your trail. Now, you won't always know everything, and that's what we're going to talk about. But you do need to know what your horse can do. So, for instance, you get into a ride and they've had a bad storm and the trail has turned pretty deep and pretty muddy, and you have a 7-year-old that's done 300 or 400, seems fairly strong, but you've never ridden it too fatigued, and you've never ridden it in a swamp. Now, that horse may go into that situation calm and cool and work on through and be fine. That horse, you may find that horse is nervous and anxious when it gets into that footing, and in which case, you know, you're going to do things completely differently. But you have to know what your horse can do, and that's the purpose of all of it. Now, you also have to have a really good feel of the depth of conditioning. Not necessarily how many days they've been doing this month, but how many years have they been doing it? Because when you go to how many years they've been doing it instead of how many months they've been doing it, you have a stronger, sounder horse that you can ask to do things and maybe step back and watch him do them. But a young horse without the depth may hurt himself. So, again, that's another aspect of trying to figure out a strategy for a ride. Age and depth of conditioning and what you know and what you think you know, how they deal with the weather, what their natural talents are. Do they have a long stride, a short stride? Can they canter long ways? Do they have a nice rocking horse kind of a canter that just goes, or are they going to fight you every inch of the way once you let them canter? Right, that's about your horse. The next thing's about you when you're figuring these strategies. Do you feel well? Did you hurt your knee last week? Did you get bucked off some youngster? Were you in a car wreck? Do you have a toothache? Do you have a headache? I mean, there's just a million things. And again, when you figure your strategy, you have to figure it in a way that you can take care of yourself so that your horse can perform to his best ability. And I can tell you that if you aren't good, your horse may do okay, may do very well, but he won't do as well as he could if you felt well. So that fits in. The environment, as I said, whether he can work in heat, whether he can work in humidity, whether he can work in the cold, all that goes into figuring out your strategy. Now, the way I do it, for the most part, is I try to know my horse well before I compete him. In my situation, the horse that I have not competed yet in 100, I will compete. And when I go to compete, Dad can tell you, I don't usually go slow unless there's some reason for it that I don't know. But you can go. I intend to go fast. I intend to stay competitive, and I haven't competed that horse yet. So, but I will know him before the ride starts. I will have done the conditioning. I will have done some galloping. I will have done some 30-mile rides. I will have done enough to know all the issues.
Yes, Jamie?
Yeah.
I think one thing people always ask is, okay, before you do the first 100, pardon? Before you do the first 100, well, how many shorter rides will have you done, 50 or 75 or whatever?
Before I compete that horse has already done 300s and probably 450s, and I've done the 50s. and I've conditioned the horse for the hundreds. But I had other horses to ride and other horses I wanted to do things with, so this horse I have not competed yet on 100, but I certainly intend to, and I certainly feel like the horse is prepared well. But I haven't done it. So let's see, what else? Anybody else have something specific to ask?
What are the things that you look for as you get to know the horse in particular that, you know, how much does it feel, how much of it is what the heart monitor tells you, you know, what?
I always use a heart monitor, and I have to say that I think that if you don't use a heart monitor, it's not that you're not qualified to ride with a horse without a heart monitor. That's silly. But I do think that you will know far more about your horse faster if you use a heart monitor. On the trail, if you've conditioned your own horse, when you go uphill, your horse's heart rate goes up. When you go downhill, your horse's heart rate goes down. Now, if you know your horse, how fast do you expect his heart rate to go down? That's really important. I don't care how high it goes. That's not an issue. But it is an issue if they come down very slowly instead of cresting the hill, and as you start down the other side, they start dropping. I count on that. And if they don't do that, that means they're not, that means they're tired. And then what you do is you ride them down the hill at a recovering kind of a trot, and at the bottom you see where you are. If you can't tell and your heart rate's still high, then it's time to slow down. But you've given them the down. You've given them the down part to do as much recovering as they can. And most horses conditioned well by the time they get to the bottom should be recovered or they need to be slowed down. Let's see. Do y'all understand that concept? Because that's really important. And that's something that everybody can do all along the way.
Yes, I understand that. I like that concept.
Yeah. You need to look for recovery. If you aren't getting the recovery you're looking for, you need to figure out why. Does he have all his shoes? Is he too hot? Should I have clipped him? Have we given him enough electrolytes? Is he getting excited because he's in company? Is he getting worried because he's by himself? Is he a horse that won't go first? Is he a horse that has to go first? All that, those things get come into play when you're trying to figure out if he can recover. So the biggest strategies that happen that come into play when I'm on the trail and competing, that's the first one. Does he recover as I expect? Is he trotting at his normal heart rate? Now, Stag Nose Bromby, and some of y'all may, but it's a little horse that I competed internationally. And one year I took her to a very early ride, and she felt like $1 million, and it was just a 50. And when I was going along, and she was trotting, and I may have been riding with Stag, but whoever I was riding with, they were perfectly happy, but my horse was trotting at 130. My horse never trotted at 130. 130 was wrong. She should have trotted at 110 or 100, somewhere like that, on a flat surface, and she was at 130. So I learned from that she will not recover quickly if she does that. She didn't recover at all. She was done. She was tired. And I stopped her. I mean, I could have got her through, but the point was she was too tired, and she didn't recover. She was going along in a flat road, trotting 20 beats higher than normal. And when I slowed her down to a walk, she should have dropped below 100. Just, you know, she should have gone to 80 or or 75, and she went to 100, 101 or 99 or right in there. And so when I took her in, I waited around for her to recover, but she was very slow. And I stopped her. And that's a strategy not to finish the ride or win, but it's a strategy to keep my horse in one piece. Go another day.
Jeannie, let me just add.
Sorry, I didn't hear you.
Okay, let me just
add. I can hear you, Zach.
Is that better?
Not yet. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. That's AT&T. The other was Verizon. I think probably everybody on the phone knows this, but each horse's numbers are very different. Super is very much like Bromby. Bromby, by the way, is the horse that won best condition in the world. But I've got a horse, Winston, who's doing very nicely. He's done 200s. He got high vet score at the North American Young Riders Championship. And 130 to 140 is normal to him. He drove me crazy the first few rides because I never had a horse that worked that high. But I finally learned that's him. So, you know, don't take magic numbers, just, you know, but what Jeannie's saying is so important. Okay, y'all shut up.
No, that's exactly right. They belong to the horse. And you need to know them. And that's why you have to do, you know, train your own horses or whatever. I mean, I don't know how, what kind of, you at least have to have that communication because you don't have a way of protecting them if you don't know those things, especially if they're staring you right in the face. Another thing that I do, I use a thermometer that measures skin temperature. And everybody says, oh, where do you get those? And that's, you get them from Radio Shack, or you figure out how to make one from indoor-outdoor thermometers. There's lots of little crazy things, but what you need is some way to read the temperature of the skin of that horse underneath your saddle. And what that tells you is what your horse is working out that he's unable to cool. In other words, if you put it on his skin, on the surface of the skin, and air blows by it, it's not telling you much of anything. That's why we put it underneath the saddle. Now, when that temperature goes up, in the horse, he has a choice of either moving or cooling. Once his temperature goes up, he can move or he can cool because he doesn't have enough blood to do both, especially if he's a little dehydrated. So most horses will move before they worry about cooling. And I can tell you a little story about that. I was competing up at Gladstone, and Stag may have been there for this one. It was 94-degree morning and as humid as it could be. And I was riding Rambo, and we were on our way from the start. Everybody ran their brains out. And I was right there with them having a great day, thinking that Rambo can run this. If those horses can do it, Rambo can do it. But I had we were probably 20 minutes from the first stop, and I looked down and my heart monitor had stopped, and I didn't know why, but you know, everybody's galloping. I couldn't just kind of stop and adjust my heart monitor, but I had a thermometer on it on him too, so I started watching the thermometer. Well, the thermometer was I think it was 102, and then it was 103, and then it was 104, and we're just going along, and I really quit looking at it, and eventually it was 100, 99, 98. Now I'm thinking that dumb thing's broken too. Well, it wasn't broken. He had stopped sending the blood to the surface of his skin to cool because he was busy running, and he didn't have enough to do all of it. And it took me a long time to figure it because I never saw that happen before. But as soon as I realized what it was doing, I slowed down. And I just walked along for probably a little while, and then I started jogging again, and his temperature went right where it belonged, which was about 100.5. He didn't really run a fever or a high temperature when he got running. The heat never bothered Rambo, so he never got really high. And again, that's not all horses. That was just him. But when I got into the stop, and I trotted on into the stop, I checked through immediately, and I was the fourth out of the stop. I had been about the 30th into the stop. But those horses all got too hot. They didn't get too tired necessarily because, I mean, they were all conditioned to run 12 miles or 15 miles or whatever it was. They should have been able to do it, but it was hot and it was humid. And they weren't able to get rid of their body heat. And so, you know, that was a good day for me, bad day for a lot of other people. And I did use a thermometer to make that work. Now, I still use a thermometer. I don't use it all the time, but I do use it particularly on young horses that I'm trying to learn. And I use it particularly on rides where there's a lot of heat and humidity, especially if I don't know the horses. I got a question? Sorry. Anybody have a question?
Well, I do. Just explain this temperature more more basically for me, because I'm not sure I'm getting it. I mean, I understand the concept, but just correct me if I'm wrong, what the horse is doing when the temperature is dropping, the skin temperature is dropping, basically is diverting the blood into the heart and the muscles and not to the blood to the surface.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
That's exactly what happens. Have you ever seen a person with that's overheated or heat stroke or heat prostration or any of the things they call them? If you touch their skin, it's clammy and chilly. The same thing with a horse. They will go into those stops overheated, and no one will ever know they're overheated because they're not even sweating unless they put a thermometer in them.
Okay.
And we do that, but back then we didn't ever do that. So does that make sense to everybody?
It does. I just wanted to make sure I was understanding it correctly.
Yeah.
This whole temperature on the skin is a whole new concept, a new
right.
toy.
Well, in Dubai, our horses started really fast, and we had thermometers on everybody because I was a fanatic anyway. And they called me. This horse was out at the fourth stop, with a temperature of 104, I want to say. And the horse wasn't acting just right. And they called me and asked me what I thought they should do. And I told them they just need to slow the horse down and just cool him. He doesn't need to race anymore. He just needs to slow down and cool him out and then gradually go back in the race again. And he'd be fine. But if they didn't slow him down and they continued to do that, that's the horses that get quite sick. So if you look at this and you play with it yourselves, it's really fun. You're not going to read a whole bunch of stuff on it because we started this research on this at the Mare Center in Middleburg, and the man that was helping us with this, Paul Semler, I don't know if any of you know him, but he got Alzheimer's, and then Dr. Kronfeld died, and I'm really the only one of the group that still messes with it, and I'm the one that got them to look at it. So, you know, it's concepts. You have to be willing to think about them, see how you can use them with your horse, if you need them with your horse. You're not really going to know unless you just try things. Or stop, take your horse's temperature all the time. You can do that, and that's fine. Beats the heck out of nothing.
No.
When we've been competing internationally, we started out, and I haven't ridden myself internationally now in probably since 94 or 96 or something like that. I don't know. I don't even. Anyway, whenever I did it, they didn't. They were checking temperatures. They checked temperatures in Italy, and that was in 1986. And if you had a temperature over 103, they pulled you. Now, I believe if you have a temperature over 103, they watch you and they recheck you, so you don't get out with that. And you can control that yourself. If you stop a horse, you'll never cool him. His blood has to keep on circulating for him to cool. So if you get in trouble with that, you want to slow them down, keep them moving, put water on them, put water and alcohol on them, whatever it takes on their skin to help them get heat out is what you want to do. Keep them wet. Keep them wet from start to finish if you can. If you carry a fanny pack or camelback and you're in heat yourself and you're getting hot, if you fix that, the mouthpiece of the camelback onto your shirt open so that it drips when you trot and when you canter, and you stay cool, your thinking is much clearer. The same thing with your horse. If you can figure out a way to keep your horse's skin wet, particularly his head, he'll work a lot longer and a lot harder, and he'll feel a lot better, and it's because of heat dissipation.
Well, that explains all the photos from Dubai at the President's Cup last year of all the UAE riders taking those jugs of water and pouring them over their horses' heads at a dead run.
Absolutely. I didn't see them, but that's what it would mean. Now, remember that the temperature of your horse's blood is, in most horses, 7 degrees cooler in their head than it is in their core. Okay? It's because the blood that goes to the head goes to the surface. And it gets, you know, the skin is cooler, more is dissipated, it's much easier to control versus the blood that goes to the intestines, lungs, goes to the spleen. I mean, that's buried beneath inflation of a sort. So remember that. Their head is cool, and if you can help them cool their head, that's cool. Now, I mentioned earlier alcohol in the water to help them cool. If you do, you don't use that on their head. And that just makes sense, telling you that, because it'll burn their eyes and then they'll be sad. So we mark the buckets. Alcohol only goes that are on, you know, that are used on. And we keep a special bucket that's quite cool for the horse's head.
Okay, but you get water on the head even before the jugular then, I guess, because that's sort of a always focused on the jugular.
Well, the jugular's coming back from the head.
Right, right.
You'll get at it faster at the head than you will at the jugular.
Okay.
And Jake, this is something Dr. Kronfeld told me. He said horses have what they call mental fatigue. And he thinks he thought that affected them. And he thought that that's what was happening to our endurance horses, and particularly to the three-day horses. I don't know if you remember any of the outcomes of the early Rolexes. Horses' temperatures got up to 111. Those horses, a lot of those horses died, and the horses that didn't die were never good competitors again because they didn't have a temperature control. And they'd just get real hot, and then they wouldn't work anymore. And he said it was a central fatigue, and it was a result of overheating. So, you know, people have given me these little hints along the way for years and years and years, and I thought about that one many times. And I think that if we took those, you're going to like this, if you would take, you know, those blue rubber things that have a cap on but you used to put hot water in or cold or something to put on
your
whatever.
Yeah.
If you would take a few of those and put water in them, and a little bit of alcohol, and put them in your freezer, they won't freeze solid. They'll just be really cold. If you could figure a way to keep them really cold and took them to your ride and set them right up there on your horse's pole when you set about trying to cool them, it would do the world a good. You can't stop sponging their faces, and you can't stop doing everything, but that would be an added way to make sure that blood that gets back to the jugular veins is cooler, because it's headed back to hot territory. And it's going to cool the body if it goes back cooler. But if it goes back just as hot as it came out, it ain't going to cool anything. But it goes deep. It doesn't go to the surface of the skin. Now, if they haven't gotten overheated, they'll get it to the surface of the skin, but it's not as efficient. Okay, anything else on that? Okay.
I can't write fast enough.
What's that?
I said I can't write fast enough. That's
oh, dear.
All the information.
The next question that I have here is, what do you think of as classic things that require re-strategizing? And what are examples of what I have experienced? The biggest one is unexpected fatigue. That requires re-strategizing immediately. What do you do with a non-recovering heart rate? You have got to change something immediately. A horse that doesn't eat, I'm pretty worried when my horses don't eat because they eat most of the time. But I must say that I will follow them along a little bit and watch them, maybe not even let them out of the stop again, but I will make that decision when the time comes. But when a horse doesn't recover or they're tireder than they should be, I mean, they're acting tireder than they should be, that requires not only re-strategizing, and you can't even figure out how to re-strategize until you figure what it is. Okay, now one of the things that makes our horses get tired in the race is we forget to keep cooling them. Come into a stop, and we cool and cool and cool and cool, and we present them to the veterinarians, and everybody is delighted, and you go back, and then you go have something to eat, and someone walks him around and lets him graze and lets him have some water. There's a good percentage of those horses that gradually get hot again because they're not moving enough. They weren't really cooled well enough. They were just cooled enough to get their temperature, to get their pulses down. And no one stuck a thermometer in them while they're standing there for their 40-minute hold or their hour hold. And then they go back to work. Those horses will be tired. And if you can figure that out and you don't let that happen anymore, you'll probably increase your finishing significantly. I mean, I know I did as soon as I figured that that was what was happening. So if they're tired and you can't really understand why, maybe they're tired because they've been climbing mountains, and these poor horses have never climbed mountains. This is new to them. That's when you rely on your pulses to tell you whether they're just, you know, they're just getting tired or whether they are tired enough. Again, you should be able to go up and you should be able to come down. And that down trip should recover them, because that's what allows you to go on. So that's the same kind of thing. Got a question? No. Okay. Then you always have to be ready to adjust things on the ride or at the ride according to things that you expect that didn't happen. For instance, you have a horse and you had to haul him 18 hours to arrive. They're supposed to leave on Wednesday, get there on Thursday, give him Friday off, and compete him on Saturday. That all sounds very ideal until your truck blows up or your tires fall off or your trailer broke or whatever happened, and you didn't get there until Thursday night or Friday maybe. That may very well contribute to your horse's fatigue. Now, if you're not running a real hard race, you're not trying to be first, and you're perfectly willing to watch your recoveries and all those kind of things, then you can go ahead out and do whatever. But if you are going to try to compete and push your horse and ask your horse for things, that may not be the time to do it unless you know your horse very well. If it's a green horse, if it's an experienced horse, if you're inexperienced, wherever the greenness comes from, and your horse comes to the competition tired, or you don't know if he's tired, then your strategy would be to start your race as you would. I don't start them slower because I'm not sure. I start them like I would start them, and that is everybody's individual way of doing things. But I would start them where I start them as a normal thing. And again, I would watch recoveries. If he's tired from his trip, if he has a slow bow because he stayed on the trailer for 3 days, if he's a little dehydrated because he traveled for so long, he will show you that by not recovering. If he handled it all quite well, he starts the race, he eats, he drinks, he recovers, he's doing fine, you keep going. But I don't think that starting out slow and doing stuff that you've never ridden them like that before is a solution. I think you'd do better to start them where you know him, and then if he doesn't match up to his old parameters, then you've tried and didn't win. I don't know if that makes sense, but I'm not really into taking a horse to a ride and not seeing what they're capable of. If that makes sense. I'm not to abuse them, but I know that I don't own a horse that can't gallop 30 miles. I mean, he may have to stop a few times in between, but I know he can do it. So if I started the ride and he'd been through misery, I know he could do 10 miles. Let's see if we do 10 miles, how he feels. Is he recovering? Is his skin good? Is his color good? Well, yeah, let's try another 20. Let's try another 5 or what, you know, however you're feeling about it. But you have to go to a level on your horse that you know when you're asking him to work. And I don't ever do rides really slow. As Stag knows, I get lost a lot, but I don't do them slow. does everybody get that?
Mm-hmm.
Now, they were talking about subtle signs if your horse isn't doing well. What do they look like? Same old one, doesn't recover. He's interfering. He never interfered before, and now he's interfering. He's forging. He's going downhill awkwardly. He usually will tuck his butt and trot down the hill. Well, today he's not doing that. He's floundering around. When he gallops with his head out and down instead of up and alert and looking where he's going. When he walks, he doesn't walk quite straight line. I've seen all of those things on the trail. And I have to say, for the most part, the riders are aware. One time, I think at Gladstone, I was walking into a stop, and the horse I was walking next to was a big brown horse, and she said, "Does my horse look all right?" Well, criminies, I don't know. I mean, I never saw the horse before. So I watched him for a little while. He's not breathing hard. He wasn't sweating, but my horse wasn't sweating either. And she walked along, and I said, "I can't see anything, but I'm not riding that horse. I don't know what your heart rates usually are. I don't know anything about your horse. So if you have any doubt at all, continue walking until you get into the stop." Well, she got into the stop, and probably 15 minutes after me, she did walk, and she did try and take care of her horse. But her horse had been overheated. And when she got in there, they did all these things, sent it back to the barns, it was pulled. And that's exactly what I told you before. You do not know when your horse starts to cool, if they've overheated, because they don't sweat. That horse stood at the barn waiting for the veterinarian to come off the trail, and the girl left it thinking, he didn't know when the veterinarian was coming, and he looked all right. He wasn't even sweating. That horse ended up foundering and dying.
Wow.
And it wasn't intentional neglect. I mean, there was lots of things that were stupid, because you'd think they would know better about this, know better about that. But, if you look at the blank facts, the horse got pulled, the girl thought that was fine, the horse was tired, she put it in a stall and gave it some hay and water and went off to do whatever and came back and the horse was having a seizure, and I think we worked on that horse for probably the next 20 hours and eventually got it good enough to get to a clinic, and when it got to the clinic, it foundered, and then it died at the clinic, I believe. I know it died, but I don't remember where it was. But it was just from not knowing or understanding what those things meant and how important temperature is and how important recoveries are and how important it is to understand how the circulation works. When I rode in Italy, Dr. McKay Smith was there judging, and the winner of the World Championship that year was Sandy Schuler, and I was second. And we had a dinner after it was all over. Matthew got up and gave a little speech, and he said it was no coincidence that the first two horses were ridden by veterinarians. Well, it's true. I mean, we had an incredible feel for physiology. And there's no reason that should be limited to veterinarians. And these subtle things that you're trying to figure out, if you understand the physiology of the horses that you're riding, they will become incredibly apparent. I tried to get one of our world teams to stop and look at that some years back, and I couldn't really get anybody interested. But I mean, if you want to compete and you want to understand what's going on underneath you, you need to understand the anatomy, you need to understand the physiology, and there's plenty of courses that you can take online, there's plenty of books you can buy, and there's plenty of endurance riders that would be happy to teach that. So I think that's kind of a big thing. One of the other ain't doing right signs I mentioned was interfering or forging. That's really important, because the way that we shoe our endurance horses, we're absolutely convinced that we have to protect them and their shoes can't be worn out at the end of the ride. And I'm a firm believer that I'd rather have their shoes worn out than their joints worn out. So I'm a firm believer in a lighter weight shoe. I want the horses to be able to put their heels down flat, their feet down flat, not heels first. And when you talk to people about it, that's not normal for a horse to put their foot down flat. Well, that's not true. If they're barefoot, most of them put their feet down flat. But when you put weight on them, they put their heels down first, because their foot works like a pendulum and it gets thrown out in front of them. And then the heel strike. Well, if they land like that for a whole 100 miles, it's 80,000 heel strikes. If people say, well, yeah, but he's just hitting it, he's not bearing weight yet. Well, if you took your foot up and kicked the wall 80,000 times, it would not matter one lick whether you had weight on it or not. So that's another thing that you can use for helping you understand the subtle changes. Understand how your horse lands. Understand how your horse is shod. Understand the effect of the shoes that you have on them. Don't leave that totally up to somebody else. And I am not criticizing farriers. I think they put their heart and soul into this. I think they try really hard to make your horse do well. But I can tell you they don't ride your horse. And you'll be able to tell light years ahead of them when things aren't right with their shoes, but only if you know to look. When Rambo first went to work, heavens, I had big heavy shoes on him. I didn't want anything to happen to him. I had heavy shoes and pads and the whole bit. And he had a tremendous heel strike, and he went lame off and on. He never stayed lame, but he went lame, and I couldn't figure out why. Oh, I x-rayed him, and they were great, and I did this, and I did that, and I finally bought a treadmill, put him on it, and I could see what happened. Well, it helped me know these things that I'm telling you now, because they aren't common knowledge. I had excellent farriers at the time. No one could tell me why his heels got so sore. One farrier told me if I'd quit riding endurance on him, he wouldn't have sore heels. Well, that would have been true, but that wasn't an answer I wanted to hear about. Other farriers said, well, we need to build his heels up. How many times have you heard people with horses with Nervikin disease, they raise their heels? Well, they don't have any business raising their heels, but they think they do, because any change in the navicular horse's feet will help him for a little while. And then, the sadness comes that it didn't help him. You take his shoes off and you turn him out in the field, that's when he starts to get better. So, again, that's something that y'all can use. Use your eyes. Learn how shoes are supposed to fit. Learn what the difference is between lightweight shoes and heavyweight shoes. I do hundreds and have done hundreds all over the world in aluminum shoes. And so I know that it can be done. I also know there are some people that absolutely can't manage to get through 100 with an aluminum shoe. Everybody doesn't have a farrier with them. Everybody, you can't afford to have your shoes wearing out in the middle. But think about that, and think about what you can do to keep your horse's feet light. Also, think about what you can do to get your horse's foot to come off the ground easy. Those are the two big things. Land flat and come off the ground easy. Well, you get them to come off the ground easy by bringing their brake over back a little bit. They don't have to stay on the ground all the way to the tip of their toe. If they do, that toe gets longer and longer and longer, and pretty soon you have a long, skinny foot, and pretty soon they get sore in their heels, and the reason is that their breakover is so slow that when they come off the ground finally, their foot snaps forward, and then they heel strike. So you want a light shoe and an easy breakover and a low heel. If you elevate the heels, they'll heel strike. If you put a heavy shoe on, they'll heel strike. And if you slow their breakover, they'll heel strike. So all those things go into alerting you to subtle changes. When they get tired, they can't control where their feet are, particularly if they're heavy. They'll show those signs quickly. I judged a ride somewhere, Maine, I guess, just recently. And I saw a horse on the second day of this ride with some small interference. And I said, what's going on here? Why don't you get some boots on this horse? And she said, well, he's never done it before. I don't know what he's doing. I think he doesn't like the sand part, or he doesn't like whatever she said he didn't like. And I just suggested that she put some boots on him because she wasn't about to change anything. Well, by the third day, the door is about the size of a 50-cent piece on both fetlocks. And I pulled him. That was enough of that. But that's the kind of thing you get into. If they're forging and they just hit the underside of their foot, that's great. But if they're forging and they grab their heel, the heel of their shoe and pull a shoe, then you're risking torn ligaments, torn tendons, torn bruised bulbs. You're risking all kinds of things with a horse that forges, and it's going to show up when he's tired. So, there.
Jeannie?
Yes.
Yeah, just to tell a bad on myself of, you know, how subtle this is. At the Old Dominion this year, and you, of course, observed this when I was showing you the course afterwards, or maybe even going in, but super, we normally, you know, like to shoe about 7 to 9 days before a ride, which works for most of our horses. Super tends to grow foot, and he only grows toe, not heel, fairly fast. But the mistake we made this year is it turned out about the same time we shod the horse, we switched pastures from our lower pasture where the horses have been to the upper pasture. No, vice versa. Pardon? Yeah, anyway, we moved them to a fresh pasture, and we'd had, you know, very lush growing weather. And as a result, his hoof grew much faster than normal. And the way that showed up in the ride was he started, you know, forging on me. Now, whether that, you know, eventually he lost a shoe coming in the last check, and that, well, long story, but the subtle change there is I should have, you know, one, not changed the pasture 7-8 days before a ride, and two, I should have been much more alert to checking his, what had happened to his hoof growth, you know, so that I could have done something right before the ride, because he had gotten longer than he should, because he is a horse, like you said, that, you know, you have to really keep after the hoof shape.
Dag, did he forage or interfere before he was tired?
I still didn't hear you.
Did he forage before he was tired?
Yeah, I was getting not steady foraging, but occasional foraging, you know, in certain types of terrain fairly early on. Well, off and on during the ride, and then it got a little bit more pronounced later in the ride when he was starting to get a little tired. He never got really tired during the ride. He was always coming in and recovering within, you know, 2 or 3 minutes. But obviously over 100 miles in the Old Dominion, he's not going to be as fresh as he is early on.
Does anybody have any questions about any of this nonsense?
No, you're doing great.
Let's see.
Actually, Jeannie, I am going to throw a question out on the table on this, in that just chewing on this one just a little bit more. You've got a horse and you're riding him, and over the course of 100 miles, there's a certain amount of leg weariness that it may or may not be inevitable, but certainly a number of horses experience it. And it's not the sort of thing that you're necessarily going to pull your horse just because he's a bit leg weary.
At least not us.
So it's like, where do you sort of draw your own mental line? You know, okay, he's, which is, you know, again, this is, you know, like super on this OD thing, his recoveries were still good. So is it just you ride the recoveries and, okay, if he's recovering well enough, then you don't worry about the leg weariness? And when does leg weariness itself become a factor that you really do have to pay attention to?
That's a great question. The leg weariness is a critical issue on a dangerous trail. If you have any doubt that you have control over where your horse is going and he has control over where he's going, if it's a dangerous trail, that's when you stop. I guess we probably all know it. Skip's horse fell off the Tevis Trail this year.
Mm-hmm.
And I have not talked to him, but Skip was leading that horse. And I know where he went off because the last time I rode the Tevis, there was a fella down there with his horse at the time I went by. And but he stopped sooner, and they got him out, and everything was fine. I think the guy broke his leg, but the horse didn't go all the way down like Skip's did, and it was not injured. as Skip's was. But Skip had reason to be off his horse. Somebody was tired. Either he was tired or his horse was tired or he just wanted to be a nice guy. I don't really know. I know Skip well, and I know that he would have never intentionally put his horse at risk. He wouldn't have ever gone out there if he thought that was a possibility. But that's one of the times when leg weariness is incredibly important. Again, if you don't know your horse, leg weariness is an issue. For instance, if you have a horse that's on the Old Dominion jogging through the rocks and he's leg weary, you want to sew his knees back together, then you keep going. But if you, you know, but if you feel like you can keep him together and his leg weariness really only shows up when you let him down in the stop, that's a time when I would keep going. Now, you have to interpret the leg weariness because you'd like to do something so it doesn't happen again. Now, Stag's horse this year had a little exercise before the Old Dominion started. And I don't, you know, I know that those horses that get loose and do their own thing are not as good as they are normally. So in that situation, I wouldn't be surprised that he showed leg weariness. And again, I would have continued as he did because he wasn't showing an issue on the trail. But when he got into the stop and, you know, let down, then maybe he looked a little tired than he normally would, but he looked good. But what causes leg weariness is what you guys need to be aware of. The shoeing causes leg weariness. Poor conditioning causes leg weariness. Inappropriate electrolyte use causes leg weariness. Everything is counting on their forearms and their hind legs, you know, and their shoulders. Everything's dependent on those items. And if their shoeing has allowed their toe to get long and they are slow coming off the ground and their heel is hard and they're getting tired, their foot's going to be slower coming off the ground and their heel's going to strike even harder and eventually they are going to be careless about where their feet are because they have no choice. They're tired now. I said electrolytes because muscles require continual use of electrolytes to function, to make energy, to put energy where it needs to be helpful, to help put feed into the horse so that he has the basics to make energy with. I mean, electrolytes are incredibly important. And if your horse is becoming dehydrated and or your electrolytes are getting out of balance, all of the systems that use them are not going to be efficient. So when you're going along and you get into the stop and the vet says, well, you've got a C on skin tent, that tells you that depending on how well you know your horse, but if you know your horse well, then that tells you what you need to do about that. If he always has that kind of skin tent because he's old and they always pinch him on his neck and he doesn't have any fat there and he's been competing for 15 years and it's not a big deal, then that's fine. But if he gets there and you don't know enough about him to know all those things and he has a miserable skin tent, you've got to look at all the other parameters too. You've got to look at his refill and his color and his attitude and how bright his eyes are and whether he's eating. All that stuff has to be evaluated along with the skin tent to see whether he is capable of making all this energy that he's going to require. Go ahead.
I would just observe, this is why it's so important to do your own, like, vet exam, because, you know, one vet's B, maybe another vet's C.
Absolutely.
you do your own and know what to expect on your horse, and you do it and you say, oh, it's a B and it should be an A, then you know it's off. Or
that's absolutely true. You it's just like your shoes. You need to, just like your physiology, you're going to be responsible for that horse ultimately. And everybody around you is going to give their best guess, me included. I'm going to give him my best shot, but you know, I'm just going to tell you what I think. I can't tell you. I can't read the future, but I'm going to give you my best information. But the real truth of the story is going to be in your guys' hands. What I was going to say a minute ago was the diet that your horse is on also plays very much into the strategy that you use during the ride and how it affects you during the ride and how quickly you have to change things during the ride. An example, if your horse is on a low-fat diet, the energy that he's going to use on his ride is stored. It's stored carbs, they're in the muscles, they're ready to go, he's going to go along, and when he runs out of them, he's going to stop. Because that's what's going to happen. If you're on a high-fat diet and you've been on it at least, I'd say at least 2 months, but I'd say 4 months to be safe, your horse, when he works hard, he's going to mobilize that fat, and he's going to get energy from that fat. At the end of the ride, he's going to look kind of gaunty, and but he's going to feel fine. He will have lost weight. The other horse will finish, and he'll be just fat and shiny and dapply and look like he hadn't done anything, except he'll just be standing there. Now, I rode a horse in Scotland. No, in England. In the European Championships in 1989, I think. And we had a U.S. team there. And I rode a horse belonging to a very good friend of mine. And I had lent her horses for here, and she lent me this horse for there. Well, we came into the first stop about 30th and left out 4th. And because that horse just recovered like crazy, and that horse could run forever. And I had, you know, I'd ridden him for about a week. And she did all the care of him. You know, he was her horse, her baby, and she just said I could ride him. I wouldn't be meddling. So when we got to the last stop, I knew something was wrong, but I didn't know what it was. That horse recovered beautifully. He ate, he drank, he looked great, but he wouldn't go. So I got out of the stop. Because, you know, he recovered beautifully. I got out of the stop, and that horse could barely trot. And I was trying to decide whether he was sick or whether he was just tired or whatever, and I'm just kind of really thinking this over. And I ran into his crew was along the road, you know, to help. It was back when you could just be anywhere you wanted. And it occurred to me to ask them what he was eating. That horse had, for a diet, less than a 1% fat. Well, he was out of energy. He didn't have any energy. He had plenty of electrolytes, because I gave him plenty of electrolytes. But when he got to the finish, all he could do is trot. And I sure wasn't going to hit him. And I told everybody just to leave him alone. I don't want to be crude. I'm not stopping. I'm just trotting to the finish. And we weren't allowed to be any sooner than 4th because we weren't allowed to get medals, because at one point in time we won the European Championship and it just absolutely upset the whole world. So they said, it's a European Championship, you can come ride in it, but you can't win it. And you can't win any medals, and so if you want to come, we don't care, but you can't win anything. Well, so that meant that the fastest I could be would be 4th, and that's actually where I was aiming. Well, I'm trying. This thing finished on a race course. Everybody's racing to the finish except me. I was trotting to the finish very slowly. And people were yelling and screaming, oh, they're going to catch you, they're going to catch you. Hurry up, hit him, get him going. And I thought, no, I'm not hitting this horse. He can't go any faster. So he trotted across the line, and he actually got fourth by about a length. And everybody was delighted except for his owners, who didn't know what was wrong with him because they never heard anything about fat. Well, he crossed the line, and they quick put a blanket on him, and there was one big, strong person at each corner. And they walked him over to his rest place, and he was eating, and he was acting fine. His pulse came right down, and I had to explain to him that he just didn't mobilize any fat. The next day, that horse looked like the fanciest show horse you ever saw. He had big dapples, and he was fat, and he was shiny, and he was medium energy. And all these other horses that were, you know, really ran their ride, the whole thing, were gaunt-looking, and they'd lost weight, and they'd lost fat. And they felt a whole lot better than he did. So that was a strategy change. What's going on with this horse? I had to work at that one. That took me some miles to figure it out. And if I didn't know physiology and I didn't know nutrition, I wouldn't have figured it out. And there was also a race of champions in Utah that happened to. These horses were climbing this mountain, and they stopped. And nobody could figure out what was wrong with them. They wouldn't go. And it was back before we put more than 3% fat in the diet of a horse. So, you need to know your nutrition, and if you know your nutrition, and you know your physiology, those strategy changes like don't hit him, don't make him hurry, don't let people stop him, those are all strategy changes. I mean, you know, I wouldn't be afraid to hit a horse to make him go as bull, but that one, it was not going to work. And it's subtle things like that that you have to. I guess you have to understand. You can't just kind of memorize all these things. You have to kind of understand because there's a lot of thinking and sorting through things when things go wrong. And if you can sort through them and fix them, you win. If you can't sort through them and you can't fix them, you have to stop. Or they
win. When you say like a 1% fat in the diet, and say you can buy grains these days that the horses will actually eat that are like 10% fat, but in their total diet, that's still probably down in the 1% range when all is said and done.
What depends?
Because they're all
what
on
kind out. Wait a minute, you got to back up. If it goes down to 1%, what else are you feeding?
Grass. Free choice grass. So they're out on grass 7 by 24, and you give them a couple of pounds of grain each day that's 10% fat.
Okay, and a horse can eat 30 pounds of feed a day, whatever it is. So if he gets how much feed, how much grain?
A couple of pounds. So if you're saying they're going to eat 28 pounds of grass and 2 pounds
of
grain.
That's a very small amount of fat.
Yeah, there's next to no fat in this.
Okay, so I'm going to tell you that that's not enough. If you're going to compete this horse hard, now, if every time you do a ride, he's big and fat and healthy and you don't have any qualms and he has plenty to, you know, plenty of carbs to draw from, then he maybe can do this without fat. But I don't think so. I couldn't run a horse now as hard as I run mine without fat. Now, when my horses get started to compete, and they're just getting started back now because they've been kind of off for a while, they will get maybe 4 pounds of grain a day, the ones that are really competing because they're on rich pasture also. But they're going to get a high-fat supplement of some kind, and they're going to get some oil because I've got to figure a way to get fat into them.
How palatable is Do you have any sources of palatable fat?
Animal fat is never palatable. So that's what you can't have.
Right.
But corn oil, there's a lot of fat supplements out there now. Platinum Performance has one. There's a lot of fat supplements that you can use. But you want to use ones that are real fat. You don't want to use ones that's 20% fat or 10% fat and mix it into his diet and think you're going to make a difference because you're not. So use fat. Use oil. Use corn oil. Corn oil works well if they'll eat it. A lot of my old horses And since then, I've been using it on more EAT. Denji, A, cubes or something they like, and I pour oil on that. And if you don't have a lot of horses and you just have to eat them all or whatever, you could just eat it.
How much oil would, you know, a vegetable oil?
How much?
Yeah, how much oil would you get up to?
If you can get them to eat 2 cups a day, that's a bunch. A half a cup twice a day. Work it up to a cup a day, or a cup twice a day if you can. Depends on how much grain you want to feed. It depends on all kinds of things. But you want to figure out how to get their diets up. And now they were experimenting around for a while with a 20% fat diet. And the problem with the 20% was that the horses were losing their appetites over it. You know, we're the same way. If we sit down to a steak dinner and we eat all the fat, we taste really good, but then our appetite sort of is sorted out there for at least a little while. You can't eat a bunch of fat and maintain a good appetite. So I think you would do better to feed more often. And feed with, you know, as much fat as you think you can get them to tolerate. We're not trying to inundate them with it. And again, you can figure that out yourself. If your horse isn't going to eat it, he isn't going to eat it. Or if he can eat it well, you're going to have an advantage.
Yeah, I've got one who you put any liquid fat, corn oil, grapeseed oil, canola oil, doesn't matter. And I mean, 2 tablespoons on a pound of grain, he won't touch it. He'll starve himself rather than eat it. Really want to wring his neck.
How about, have you tried any of the fat powdery supplements like Platinum Performance?
I need to do that.
Those are 20% fat. A lot of what Platinum Performance itself is, but a lot of those fat supplements are powdery kind of a supplement, and they're 25% fat, and something like that mixed in with, you know, grain would boost your fat content pretty quick.
Yeah, that would be, that's worth thinking about looking into. I've been able to get away without it because we've only been doing like 50s, and we're now going to take him into his first 100, and it's like, okay, I got to get serious about this.
I'll have to kind of figure it out, and I don't know all the answers, but I'm giving you general ideas on what you're trying to aim at. And like I was saying about the shoes, everybody can't wear aluminum shoes. I can tell you there are those horses out there that just can't do it, but the horses that can do it are going to be ahead. The horses that will eat fat well will be ahead, just like the people that, you know, take really good care of them versus the horse that doesn't get well taken care of. That horse is going to have an advantage. So some of them are natural advantages, and some are advantages that, you know, you can affect.
Let's go ahead and do one or two questions. Let's see.
I got one here on electrolytes. You want to do that one?
Yeah. Okay, good. You got it up in front of you because I lost my page here. Go ahead.
Okay, one of them, it says, how do you adapt to changing weather conditions over the course of the ride? We're going to tie that one in with what do you start with as your electrolyte strategy and how might that change? I use an electrolyte that I'm comfortable with. I use all the time. And I watch how my horse performs with it. If he keeps eating and drinking and doing well with that electrolyte, he doesn't suffer from dehydration, and he does end up with plenty of energy, and I just can't think of any way to improve him, then your electrolyte is probably perfectly adequate. But if he gets into the first stop and he's not eating and he's not drinking and you're wondering what's wrong with him, chances are your electrolyte isn't adequate. Either the one you're using isn't adequate or the amount you're giving isn't adequate. The amount you give I don't think, unless you're really nutty, that you can overdo electrolytes. I've never seen a case of anybody overdoing electrolytes where the horse's kidneys functioned correctly and they were not water deprived. The only time I've ever seen it be a problem, you can get salt toxicity if you have electrolyted, and a horse never gets to water. We're not talking about a horse that won't drink when he gets there. We're talking about one that doesn't get to water. And that salt toxicity, his salts will get very high. If his electrolytes are low, he will not eat and he will not drink. And they don't drink and they don't eat a whole lot faster with low electrolytes, low sodium, than they do with high electrolytes or too much. And so I think that too much is a myth. But I do believe, you know, you can use some judgment. Now, people ask me what I do. The most important thing is to figure a way to use electrolytes in your horses that they don't find really offensive, because that's not fair. You don't want one that burns your mouth. You don't want one that upsets your stomach. You don't want one that you can't figure out how to get it into them because it just absolutely won't tolerate it. So that sort of those things are important. So what I do is I use the electrolyte that I use the night I use before they get on the trailer. If it's a reasonable length of ride and I don't have to worry about taking them on off the trailer all day or anything, I'm just going to go for a few hours away from home. They'll get it before they get on the trailer. They'll get it when they get to the ride and get off the trailer. They'll get it the night before the ride. They'll get it the morning of the ride. And they'll get it every stop. Now, the only thing that changes that with me is the volume. Because I believe that spreading it out over time is your best bet. I'm not going to slow down or use it some different other times. I also don't believe it's stopping in the middle of the trail and getting off and giving your horse electrolytes. I don't think that timing is anywhere near that critical. I think that you waste time and take risks, and I don't think it's important. I think what's important is that when you leave the stop, you feel like you've given your horse plenty of electrolytes to go the next 20 miles or whatever the distance is. If your horse has a problem and you have to do it, that's fine. I really don't know who they would be, but I think they're out there. But in general, your horse should be able to get to point A, from point A to point B on said amount of electrolytes. Now, what makes me change or stick to a volume that I use? I usually use 2 ounces. And the way you figure out what you use is you can look at the concentration of the given electrolytes in the electrolyte you're using, and you can look at the electrolytes that are in the sweat of the horse, and you can read some of Gary Carlson's work that tells you how much they sweat in a given amount of time. I mean, if you want to get real scientific, that's... And what I have figured out is that they store a tremendous amount of electrolytes in their gut anyway. If you never gave them any, and you hear people say, well, I don't use those things, well, that's why they get away with it, because we don't know how much they can store, but we know they can store a lot. So I think what you have to do is use a certain amount of electrolytes and watch and see how your horse does. But when it gets hot, when it's humid, when he doesn't sweat, when he's working harder than normal, when he's going faster than normal, when you're working harder than normal, he's going to probably require more. On those stressful times, particularly in hot weather, I give them more. I may go from 2 ounces a stop to 3 ounces or even 4 ounces at a stop. Now, I don't use 4 ounces very often, but I certainly have used 3 ounces in the middle of the ride through maybe the last stop. I don't continue at that high level unless there's a good reason. Once it gets cool, they aren't going to use so much. So you can do that. There's something else I was going to tell you about that. Oh, I forget.
So how many ounces are typically in a tube? Let's say the Enduramax Plus.
Enduromax Plus is pitiful. I hate to tell you that. But that's not even really a whole dose.
It's not what?
Not really a whole dose. There's so much stuff in that that there isn't a whole lot of electrolytes. And, you know, I know that, you know, that's Enduromax Plus is supposed to be what I suggested, but they really made that up without ever asking me. But if you look at the label on Enduromax and compare it to the label on that Plus, you'll see that that's, I don't even think that's 2 ounces worth of electrolytes. I don't think. But look,
I typically
look and read and understand. I don't have anything here to look for you, or I'd look it up. But
I don't have a tube in front of me. I know I just shoved the whole tube in. I mean, I know.
And it seems like you're doing a lot, but you're really not. That's what I'm saying. So what you need to do is you need to get the powder and look at it, and you need to compare it with what's in that tube. What's in that tube basically is to settle their stomach for
the buffering agent.
Right.
Yeah.
And now I just had many conversations with KER about Enduromax, and we're changing the formula. It should be changed by now, but I haven't seen it, the label, so I don't know for sure. But we lowered the potassium in it and increased the sodium and chlorine in it. And I think that was important. I don't understand the potassium as much as I probably should, but I've read and read and read, and we've done some research rides, and I haven't been convinced one way or the other that we should or should not have potassium. I can see sometimes where it raises or lowers the threshold for firing of certain nerves, and they think that it may be responsible for heart irregularities in the horse during endurance rides, too much potassium, muscle quivers. But I have seen that stuff, and I have taken blood samples for 30 years, and I've never seen a high potassium level in an endurance horse. I've only seen low ones. So I don't really know why that's the way it is. I do know that our research ride, the last one that we did with, were you there, Stag, with Tanya down at the 4-H Center?
Yeah, Carol and I were both of those.
Okay, well, that one.
We had a problem at one of them because it wasn't coming out of the tube. She got the experimental dosage.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't get it into the horse, so she had, her horse actually, I think, thumped, right, or whatever, yeah.
Okay, well,
that was the one that Super actually won the second.
Well, the point is about that particular one. When they tallied all the results, and we published that because, you know, I helped them publish that, that's the most positive writing that I've ever seen on lowering the potassium rate in horses.
Right.
And so the result of that, I think Tanya is now making an electrolyte for Dubai or somebody with no potassium in it. And I'm not at all sure that makes sense. But I also can't stand here and say it doesn't. I really don't know. And I think that particular product's going to have to get out there, and we're going to have to see where it's useful. In Dubai, my God, they run around the desert all day long, and they run 90 miles an hour, and it's just completely different than it is here.
Yep.
So it may be something that they could have as useful or not. I don't know the answer. But they use a lot of potassium when they compete, but they also have a ton of potassium in them. Remember that all the grass they eat and all the hay they eat is very, very high in potassium. So, again, that may be why they didn't think we needed to supplement it. But in any case, we did lower it in Enduromax. Never was very high in Endurolite. And we also I asked them to change the formula on the Enduromax because it was caustic. And I was kind of sad when I went and studied the pHs and stuff and found out that they had changed that formula from what we started to what it was before we changed it last time. But anyway, now it should be, it should, I don't think it's going to be caustic anymore. I don't think that it has too much potassium in it. I think it's a really good concentrated formula. But anyway, blah, blah, but it's important to know that without an electrolyte at their fingertips, these horses can't make energy, nor can they put that energy where it belongs to use it. And that's why those horses get tired. What else?
Maybe they adapt to the weather conditions and how you...
High heat and high humidity are the worst worst situations that they can deal with or they have to deal with. When we go from the East Coast to the West Coast to compete, we go from high humidity to low humidity, and our horses do quite well. When those horses come here, they go to high humidity. They can't cool. They don't do well. That's why they don't come anymore. You know, it's rare for somebody from the West Coast to come here to compete. So when you have a situation where there's tons of sweating, you need more electrolytes than you do other times. You don't need... You need to know what's happening. For instance, if you go to the Tevis Cup, and it's a nice arid kind of deal, and their sweat is evaporating as soon as they make it, does that mean they need less electrolytes? No, they still need the electrolytes. Their sweat is being made and coming out of them and just evaporating. You're not seeing it, but it's certainly there because they certainly have to cool those. You know, the canyons are 102, 103, and the mountains are pretty hot too. So it's not a cool ride by any means. So, but because they don't sweat, you still need to understand that they do require, you know, a pretty significant amount of electrolytes. When you get humidity, you also require a lot of electrolytes. And you need to encourage them to get rid of heat by keeping them cool with water alcohol, or whatever, along with their own sweating, because they can't evaporate the sweat. The sweat just sits there, and they get hot and hotter and hotter. So you have to keep that off them, but as long as you are getting it off them and they are continuing to sweat, they're going to require more electrolytes. So the way the electrolytes work and the things that affect it are temperature, humidity, conditioning of your horse, the diet he's on, how much exercise he's gotten, how fit he is. I mean, everything goes into what you need to know to put the electrolyte package together for your horse.
Jeannie, I would also add that footing, in other words, I think mud, they're going to work a lot harder. That also is another factor.
Say that again. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you, Stig.
I remember somebody did some research that said sand and mud make a surprising amount of difference also. The weather might be okay, but if they're on footing where they're using their muscle more as opposed to their spring system, then they're going to go through electrolytes a lot faster.
Yep, that's very true. That's very true. One of the things that you all can do that I've found really pretty helpful. When I go to a ride the night before, I'll take one of those flat pans, you know, the rubber ones that you feed out of, and I'll put some grain in it, and I will just plaster it with electrolytes. Well, they're not going to eat something real salty quick, but during the course of the night, they'll eat 4 or 5 ounces of electrolytes if it's in that grain. And that, you know, that's kind of a good feeling when you leave out there in the morning and you know they've had that much electrolytes during the night. And then the other thing, Wait a minute. Besides that, was something else I was going to tell you. Oh, the other thing that I've stumbled upon over the years is a way to give them their electrolytes. And I hate abusing them. I hate for them to hate me because I'm going to do it again. We've been putting it in molasses now instead of applesauce, instead of yogurt, instead of all the other things that we were sure were the best things to ever use. It seems that molasses does a better job. They don't spit it all out. They must not mind it. I mean, I can give it to Wonder, and she doesn't even fuss at me over it. The next thing you might want to think about doing is after you've given them their electrolytes, rinse their mouth out so that if they want to, they can go back and eat or eat along the way or whatever. So the more work you do, the hotter it is, the more humidity you have, the fatter the horse, the more he's going to sweat, the more electrolytes he's going to need. And pay attention to what, if you can get a hold of those things that Dr. Carlson wrote, that was in the old Endurance News. Do you have a copy of any of those, Stag?
I don't know. We have them pretty far back. Do you know approximately what year?
Well, let's see. What was The AERC that was Land Between the Lakes, whatever year that
was. We'll be up so we can track down.
Okay, whatever year that was, it should have been during the previous year, because I used those articles to put together the formula for Endurolite, and because we didn't have anything for horses back then. And Dr. Carlson, looked at what I had done and whatnot, and I had told him, I read those articles, and those articles said how much salt was in sweat, how much they sweat over a period of time, and how much sweat they'd lose in a 50-mile race, things like that. So if you could find those, that would be great. If you can't, Stag, let me know, because I may have them here somewhere.
Okay, we'll take a look.
Which year type of thing? What was the distinguishing factor of that particular LBL? Because I think it ran for a number of years.
What, at that ride, you mean?
Was it the year the race of champions was the LBL or AOC National Championship? Or?
I'm sorry. I'm having a terrible time understanding you. Try again.
The LBL was run a number of years, and you were sort of tagging Dr. Carlson's article to the LBL. And the question is there...
What's LBL stand for?
The Land Between the Lakes.
There was only one there that I know of, and it was a two-day... One
75 and 75?
Yeah.
That was the Race of Champions. Okay, got it.
The year Annie was like second or something.
Yeah, it might have been. Was that there? That's not the year she got sick.
No, that was not the year. That was the year, as I understand it. This is, for those who don't know on the call, Annie was Maggie Price's horse. And I think Valerie Kanavy was riding Annie the year she got second because Maggie had been injured or something. The thing I remember is that Annie's full name was Romegla Kanavy Ann. And the closer the horse got to the front, the more it became Kanavy and the less it became Ann in the name.
Would be right.
Yeah, okay, so we can find that. Okay, why don't we go around with, it's about time to wrap up, but let me make sure everybody has a chance to ask a question. Rick, do you have any questions you'd like to ask right now?
No.
Okay. Allison?
No, the only thing I was going to say was that one thing that works for us on electrolytes going out to tennis was that Kazar just will drink buckets and buckets of water with electrolytes in it. And can you guys hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, because I had it on mute. And he drank electrolyte water all the way across the country and got out of that trailer out there 2,800 miles later looking every bit as plump as he did when he left here. Sarah was thrilled. She said she was going to have to try that with her horses, but he won't necessarily drink it on ride day, but he'll drink it in camp all day long, and he'll drink it on the trailer, so he just likes it.
When we sent the horses down from Amsterdam to Spain, we traveled with them all those days, and every day when we stopped in the middle of the day and we stopped at night for the first 2 days, I tubed them because we were panicking about having to compete after all 5 days of traveling. It was really, really hot. But the third day, we started putting electrolytes in their water, and I can't remember whether it was Performan Win. I want to say maybe that was it.
Yeah, that's his magic formula. He just loves that stuff in water.
Yeah, well, I think we had exactly the same experience. I think they drank and drank and drank it on the trail. I didn't have to tube them anymore. But, once we got there, that was the end of that story.
Yeah, but it works for me. Because like if he'll drink it, leading up to the ride, then I'm happy, and then I can switch over and tube him after that. But
yeah, absolutely. I absolutely agree with you. The most important thing is to not let them get behind the eight ball on the way.
Yeah.
I think it was Performan when we used, and it did a great job.
Yeah, he thinks that's Kool-Aid.
Okay, good. Good. Stephanie?
No, but thank you. This has been great.
Okay.
Sure. Hi, I'm good. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, I know you're good. I've got one thing that I suspect Jeannie's going to yell at me for doing this, but I'll give you the chance. Going on the Old Dominion this year, for those who don't know, Super, the night before the ride, hit the creek they had no business being in, spooked a bunch of horses. Unfortunately, Cheryl and I were giving the new riders briefing, and we didn't catch our horses, and they got loose, and Super went into barbed wire three places and then went running all over the mountain. Not what I wanted the night before the Old Dominion. Fortunately, Jeannie was there and looked at the horse and tried them out for the ride bets and all, and then a couple of people were nice, and Cheryl were nice enough to keep him walking much of the night, so he didn't stiffen up too badly, although he had some pretty nasty barbed wire cuts. So we did the ride, and he felt good on trail the whole way, except going out of the one-hour hold, I felt as we left camp, he was not quite right. He's a little bit stiff, but he worked out of it pretty quickly to the last hold. And somewhere, I think within the last mile or so coming into the 2 miles, I'd lost a shoe. And so he trotted out and passed. He and the three of us came in together, and he and the other horse recovered right away, and the other horse a couple minutes behind that. In fact, we all agreed to a three-way tie for first place, which was blown Henry's mind. But he'd lost the shoe, so he had to stand around for 15 minutes while he got the shoe put on, which meant he really stiffened up. And so I told the other two, go on. I was going to work to get him loosened up, and if he loosened up enough, then I'd go ahead and try to finish. And here's where I need your opinion. I decided, it was already getting close to dark, that I would walk and jog on foot the last part. Now, I didn't jog downhill on foot. I walked all the downhills. In fact, I ended up walking most of it because it got so dark I couldn't see. If you're on the horse, you can trot at night because they can see better than you can. And I got into camp, trotting out. He wasn't sound enough to complete, but they let me work on him. And, after lunging and massaging and all that good stuff, I got him to the point where he was able to complete. But we've gone from high for first to attempt. I actually think I made a mistake, and that's what I'm sort of asking you, Jeannie. I think he would have been better off if I'd kept him with a steady trot rather than, walking and trotting in on foot, and would be interested. When you get a horse that's getting a little bit, in this case he was, stiff from injuries from the barbed wire, that they're actually better off with, something more vigorous than a walk.
I think you're right. I mean, I think that it was just like that horse that I rode in Europe that, you know, he was stuck at the trot. He could go faster. But he was definitely better off for moving than he would have been if I had been walking him. And I think the same for Super. The only thing that I think that I pray that you don't do anymore is lead your horses down hills. They aren't interested in you leading them down hills. They can't balance their hindquarters.
Yep.
So if your horses are tired, stay on them and use your legs and your hands and your weight to help them get down the hill so that they don't just lurch from side to side. I don't remember, I don't know if you remember, some years ago up at the Vermont ride, there was a gray horse up there. It was Nutstags. And that horse, I was judging, and this horse was getting tired and tired and more tired and more tired. And I said, what in the world? Will you slow down? Whatever's happening out there, your horse isn't going to finish. Well, I've been leading him. He was leading him down all these hills. And this horse is behind, just absolutely quit. And it would not have if he had just ridden the horse in balance and let him keep on going. That's a strategy thing, for sure. Keep your legs against your horse and keep your horse working going downhill. It is not the time for him to be allowed to just kind of get down to the bottom, however he happens to choose to do it. There's one other thing that I wanted to mention. These are just kind of hints that I've learned over time. When it's hot, keep your horse wet and keep you wet. When it's cold, you have to keep your horses warm. Now, we had a ride at the Biltmore some years ago that it got real cold and rained and rained and rained. I think we had 7 horses tie up that year. And when you have a situation where it's cold and it's raining and you have a competition the next day, keep your horse warm. It's not okay that you just put a blanket on them, wrap their legs, get them in the trailer if they're in muck up to their eyeballs. But they've got to stay warm because that chilling and chilling and chilling, the next day they can't work very well, as we kind of really saw on that ride. So wrap their legs, blanket them, put them in the trailer if you have to. If you don't have a lot of fancy equipment to keep them dry, get a space blanket. You can ride in a space blanket using it for a rump rug if you don't have a rump rug. But if you're going to ask these horses to work, because remember, a lot of times these horses are clipped. So if you're going to ask them to work and it's been cold, it's not fair unless you've been keeping them warm. So there. I don't think I have anything else.
That's great.
Let me mention one thing. If anybody, it's a bit of a last minute, but we are having an ATEX clinic up at our clinic this coming weekend, Muscles in Motion, and Mike Scott, who's a massage and saddle fitter, will be there along with Ann Stewart and Lisa Maxwell and myself. And now the bonus, Kerry Ridgway, actually, who was supposed to be out in Colorado, but his clinic got canceled. So Kerry's going to be there doing private treaty work on horses, on, you know, acupuncture and chiropractic and all the good things Kerry does.
Where is this?
It's at our place. And out Canada, not by that. Fine. So if anybody wants to come, or you know anybody else who would be interested, as I said, Mike will be doing, in addition to the sort of the clinic stuff, he'll be doing saddle fitting, and Kerry will be doing Kerry's thing. So we love seeing you. Again, congratulations on Allison.
Yes.
Have a good day.
Thanks.
Wow.
And I'll get the website updated, Allison. Thank you very much for sending the article.
Sending that to you, but somebody asked me if it was posted out there, and I said, well, I'll just send you an email.
Yeah. I think that's cool.
I would have written it, but I'm kicking, and Stag was one of the people that convinced me that I was doing the right thing. And then actually, I rode Skip's horse, Ice Joy, with Skip on Tuesday, the week ahead, and rode out to No Hands and rode back, and she gave me a beautiful ride, and I decided I had absolutely made the right decision not to ride the horse because I am so afraid of ice. So such a fabulous one. Yeah, Skip can tell you the language I used while I was riding along, and I was leaning very strongly into the hill, and I told him, I said, but don't worry, because when I'm coming back the other direction, I'll be leaning the other way, and the horse will be perfectly balanced. it was terrifying to me. So I admire anybody, Jeannie, who's done it a number of times. It was not my cup of tea. So.
Well, tell me how is Skip? Because no one's, I haven't talked to him.
You know what? Pretty well. We were camped together the whole time with the Godwins, and Skip and my husband were good friends and rode together a lot. And so it was terrible. We waited for him to come back into Forest Hills because Sarah had come and gone, but we had plenty of time, you know, before we had to get to the finish, and waited for him. Barb was much worse shape than Skip. You know, he was heartbroken, but we all left when we all left Auburn, and he and all the ladies had flown back, and he and Pete were driving the two rigs, and we told them we were spending the second night at Rush Creek picking up a horse that was coming back to the southeast, not for me. And so he called me the second day and said, I think we'll come to Rush Creek, give me the phone number, and he came, and we all went out to dinner and had some alcohol and toasted Ice Joy, and then he told some wonderful stories about her, and unfortunately his axle on his trailer broke that same day about 10 miles before he got to Rush Creek, but he couldn't have been in a better place because they took care of him. They had places to put the horses out. And then he called me day before yesterday and said, we need to find a place in Columbus. Can you get on the internet and find me a place to stay? And I did. And then I got home and plugged my camera into my computer and found that I had taken candid shots of him riding Ice earlier that week. So I emailed them to him, and he sent me a wonderful thank you and said he was home. He had slept for 14 hours, and I think he's okay. I think, you know, it was a hideous trip. Ice was the only one of the three horses he hauled out there that even started the ride. Ashley's horse was lame. The other horse tied up. It was kind of a horrible, horrible trip all the way around, but I think he's okay.
I'm really glad
Okay.
I was certainly worried. Well, thank you guys very much for having
recovery. Thank you very much, Jeannie.
Okie dokie.
We'll talk again.
I'll be in touch. Bye now.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.